Glories to the lotus feet of Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the 10th canto, chapter 15, verse 37 and 38. What's on the board? 38 is on the board, so I'll read 37 by myself. Tamstana patata krishno ramascha nepalilaya grahita pascha charanan prahinotrina rajasu. Translation: O king, as the demons attacked Krishna and Balaram, easily seized them one after another by their hind legs and threw them all into the tops of the palm trees. Now today's verse. Fala prakara sankirnam. Daitya deher gata shubhihi. Raja bhusa talagre. Ganeri vana bhastalam. Fala prakara sankirnam. Daitya dehair gata subihi. Raja buhu satala grer. Ghanairi vana bhastalam. Vaishnavas. Fala prakara sankirnam. Daitya deher gata shubihi. Raja talagre. Ganairi vana bhastalam. One more. Fala prakara sankirnam. Mataji. Daitya deher gata subihi. Raja bhusa talagraher. Ganairi vana bhastalam. Fala prakara. With heaps of fruits. Sankirnam. Covered. Daitya dehai. With the bodies of the demons. Gata asubihi. Which were lifeless. Raraja. Shone forth. Buhu. The earth. Satala grai. With the tops of the palm trees. Ganahe. With clouds. Eva. As Nabhatalam, the sky. Translation and purport. The earth then appeared beautifully covered with heaps of fruits and with the dead bodies of the demons, which were entangled in the broken tops of the palm trees. Indeed, the earth shone like the sky decorated with clouds. Purport. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the bodies of the demons were dark, like dark blue clouds, and the large quantity of blood that had flowed from their bodies appeared like bright red clouds. Thus the whole scene was very, very beautiful. The Supreme Personality of Godhead in his various forms, such as Ram and Krishna, is always transcendental. And when he enacts his transcendental pastimes, the result is always beautiful and transcendental. Even when the Lord performs violent acts, like killing the stubborn ass demons. Om Agyanantitimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Hey Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gauratvishe Namaha Vanchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna, welcome and good morning. Before I start today's lecture, I'd like to seek the blessings of all the devotees, your well wishes, your blessings, your desires that we can speak something inspiring and purifying for all of us. Although I'm not qualified to speak on Krishna's pastimes, still we have to do it. Hare Krishna. So, this particular verse we're reading and this particular pastime we've been studying, we've heard some really wonderful things about it already. His Holiness Radha Govinda Maharaj was here 2 days ago, Radha Raman Maharaj was here 2 days ago, and he basically narrated the entire pastime for us with his particular mood of Vrindavan. It was really nice. And yesterday also Mother Krishna Leela read from Ananda Vrindavan Champu, Krishna Archana Mataji, like me. Something's wrong this morning. This is not a good start to a class. I'm like, like getting all the names wrong. So yeah, Mother Krishna Archana, she read from Ananda Vrindavan Champu about this particular excerpt from the Srimad, this particular pastime from the Bhagavatam. So the point that really caught my attention in this purport in this verse was how Krishna and Balaram, by attacking these ass demons, even though the body of a dead animal is quite ghastly, but here you can see that the body is being compared to a dark cloud, and the pools of red blood, and the tall trees, and the piles of fruits, and our acharyas are explaining this create a very, very beautiful scene in the atmosphere, which is very counterintuitive. Dead bodies and pools of blood don't usually appear very beautiful unless you have a very tamasic consciousness, very dark state of mind. But I was thinking about this point a lot last night. I was thinking about how in this world we're so much in search of beauty, isn't it? Especially Mother Krishna Archana can relate, she's an artist. But I remember also as a young person, I lived in Europe for a year, and it was like such a passion for me to go to all the museums that I could go to and look at, went to so many amazing museums. And I always thought paintings were very nice because when I look at the world around me, I see so many people fighting, so much hate and envy and selfishness. But a painting seemed like such a perfect world, right? Everything seems so beautiful. The colors are amazing. The people look amazing. Everything is so beautiful. It's it's a painting. There's no fighting. There's nothing evil going on. And then at one point in my life, I decided to study the biographies of my favorite painters like Vincent van Gogh and Francis Bacon. And I couldn't even make it through most of their life stories because it was just so dark and depressing. I mean, Van Gogh was basically a chronic depressive his whole life. He cut off his own ear. And what to speak of so many others, Gauguin died of like an STD in like some Polynesian island. I mean, they were all like loners, depressed. So then I thought, well, that's sad, but what about philosophers? So then I really got into philosophy and I read Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and Camus, and I thought, this is beautiful. Look at these great ideas about humanity and the state of the world. What beauty exists in ideas, you know? Then I would learn a little bit about their personal lives and I would find, wow, these guys are like basically killed. Many of them committed suicide. So I was like, what's going on here? Is there any beauty in this world? It's not in the human interactions that I'm having. It's not in the environment. We've practically contaminated the earth with all the pollution. So is there beauty in this world? You know, I had this question. And then I came to Krishna consciousness. And when I started studying the Gita, I remember I was particularly struck by this one verse. Krishna says in the 15th chapter, the Kalaim Ashashvatam. How does the verse start again? Charnashru. I didn't bother to remember. Just the first line. I always remember the rest once I remember the first line. Krishna is saying to Arjuna that this entire material world, from the planet of Lord Brahma down to the lowest ant, are suffering from repeated birth and death. Ah, Brahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravartina Arjuna. Naiti Mamiti So Arjuna. So he was saying that all living entities in this material world, from all the way from Lord Brahma down to the ant, are in a state of suffering and anxiety. Why? Because they have to face repeated birth and death. And I remember really being struck by this verse because think about what that means. It means that everything that we hold dear, everyone that we hold dear, could disappear at any moment. I mean, think about everything you appreciate about your life. Maybe it's your good health. Maybe it's your ability to do something. Maybe there's a devotee you really care about. None of this will last. And I remember when it really sunk into me, I was like, now I see why they say the material world is a horrible place. Because everything I like and I enjoy and I want to be with can be separated from me at a moment's notice. I could lose my phone today. I could lose a dear friend. We heard on the weekend how Atharva Prabhu passed away in Michigan. That same morning, my mom called me telling me one of my brother-in-laws had passed away. That same exact morning, double cardiac arrest. 6 hours later, Atharva Prabhu passes away. And I was just like, Krishna, what's going on here? Are you trying to like help me? Because I felt really heavy actually that day because of, you know, two deaths in one day. Like, wow. But that's the reality of this material world. And Krishna's trying really hard to get Arjuna to understand this. And I saw that by this verse and by learning more about Krishna consciousness, my understanding of finding beauty in the world was being a little bit shaken. There's another really beautiful verse in the fifth canto. I'd like to read just a small excerpt from it. It's funny, when I first joined, Jai Jagannath liked to read to me the heaviest sections of the Bhagavatam. It was like his, I don't know, something he really liked doing. We would read the heaviest verses in the Bhagavatam together. And I think he was doing it just to train my intelligence. And it was good, actually. So this is, I remember reading this with him. This is the 14th chapter of the 5th canto. It's called The Forest of Material Enjoyment. And it really paints a very stark and very realistic picture of the nature of this world. So this is just a few lines from the verse. It says, "The path of this material world is full of material miseries, and various troubles disturb the conditioned souls. Sometimes he loses and sometimes he gains," right? We see this. I see this with many of my family members. My brother will call me sometimes. He sounds really happy. I'm like, what worked out? I always ask him, like, what worked out? And he's like, well, you know, I just got a promotion, or my boss put me on a new project. I'm like, okay, great. Sometimes he'll call me, sounds really sad. I'm like, okay, what happened? What's wrong? You know, this is just how it is. I've seen this in his life, in so many people's lives. You know, sometimes you've talked to them and everything's working out. They sound really happy. And sometimes nothing is working out, you know. And this is just how it is in the material world. In either case, the Bhagavatam says, the path is full of danger. Sometimes the conditioned soul is separated from his father by death or other circumstances. Right? So many times people are often feeling morose or sad because they can't be close to their wives or their girlfriends, or maybe they really miss their mom. People carry a lot of trauma in their heart sometimes because they lost a loved one at an early point in their life. And these aren't things to take lightly, you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to mention these things because these aren't significant. These are very significant. But what the Bhagavatam is pointing out, that these things consume our consciousness. And we move through the world always carrying the weight of this loss, of having lost something, having lost someone. That's not a very nice place to be, frankly. Leaving him aside, he gradually becomes attached to others. So then you lose one person, so you become attached to others, like his children. In this way, the conditioned soul is sometimes illusioned and afraid. Sometimes he cries out loudly out of fear. Sometimes he's happy maintaining his family. Sometimes he's overjoyed and sings melodiously, right? Like, what was that famous movie? Singing in the Rain? What was it called? Singing in the Rain. Anyway, no, Singing in the Rain. This famous movie about this nanny who goes to Europe, takes care of these kids, and the whole movie is filled with scenes of her singing through the Austrian countryside. Wow, it looks so nice, right? So you think, well, maybe I should go and become a nanny in Austria. And then you go there and you realize the family sucks or the kids don't like you. It's actually really annoying to clean up after them. So everything is just painted really nicely, like, yeah, you'll just run through the countryside singing songs. It's never like that. Sometimes he's, okay, I read this line already. In this way, he becomes entangled and forgets his separation from the Supreme Personality of Godhead since time immemorial. That's the point. When Srila Rompa Swami was here over the weekend, he said the conditioned soul's biggest problem is he's constantly distracted by an opportunity he should pursue or a problem he should solve. This is our whole mentality. Like, here comes an opportunity, right? Bhakta Jack's thinking, I'll go to UIC, I'll get a computer science degree, I'll work at Google, I'll buy a house in the suburbs, then I'll invite devotees on Friday nights. Let me work on this for the next 15 years, you know? Or, here's a problem I need to solve, you know? This devotee doesn't like me, this thing's not working, I don't have any money, you know? My health is not so good, I should really start doing a lot of exercise and eating healthy. You know, we just get totally consumed. We just don't know how to do either of those for the pleasure of Guru and Krishna. Let's say not we, me, I don't. I'm still very new in my spiritual life. So then what happens, the Bhagavatam says, he becomes entangled in these contemplations, you know, trying to receive solutions for his pain and trying to pursue the opportunities that the material world presents for him, right? Can anybody relate to this? Am I the only one here who can relate to this? Can anybody relate to this? No? Anybody? Adam? Anyone? Yeah, this is how it is. We just, opportunity. And then when we meet the devotees are like, hey, Prabhu, haven't seen you in a while. Or, hey, Mataji, what's going on? Yeah, I'm just taking care of myself right now. You know, I'm just really focusing on myself, really working on what's important. I hear this all the time from devotees who, and it's good, you should work on yourself. We don't want unhappy, broken devotees. No, we should work on ourselves. We should feel satisfied. But the Bhagavatam is pointing out, though, that sometimes in our pursuit of taking care of ourselves, we overdo it. We overdo it to the point where we forget. We become entangled. We forget our separation from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And at that point, what's the use? We spend all this time taking care of ourselves, and that self isn't even who we are. So we lost out. We lost on the opportunity to cultivate our eternal relationship with Krishna. And the self is anyway not ours and not in our control. It could give us up at any point. You don't give up the body gives you up. Did you know that? We think we're in control of our bodies, but no, the body gives up on us. It chooses when it wants to be healthy. It chooses when it wants to no longer exist anymore. I mean, I'm saying it a little poetically, it's your karma, you know, like that. But my point is, I'm not in control of how my body ages, of how my body transforms. If I did, I would be like 6 feet tall, I would sound like Robert De Niro, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't work like that. My body just has a will of its own, right? But we live in this illusion that I can control my body. I can make my body act as I want it to. But that's not how it works. So we invest all this time and energy to take care of the self, but the self is not in our control anyways, and then we lose out on our opportunity to discover our true self, our eternal relationship with Krishna. Thus, the Bhagavatam says, he traverses the dangerous path of material existence, and on this path, he's not at all happy. Heavy stuff. It sounds a little depressing, sounds a little pessimistic, but actually it's very optimistic because it's kind of like, you know, someone wants to go, like you know, if you want to go out and I tell you like, hey, it's really rainy outside and it's stormy and the weather's really dark. And you're like, come on, Prabhu, don't be so negative all the time. Like, no, I'm just telling you to take an umbrella, you know. It's kind of like that. The Bhagavatam is just saying, just be prepared that your highest fulfillment will not come in this world. Just be prepared that the satisfaction you seek, the meaning you seek, the true bliss that your soul is hankering after, just know that you're not going to find it here. That's all the Bhagavatam is doing. And that's actually very nice. It's very nice if that someone can warn you, just like if you lost your keys and I tell you, you're not going to find them in the ashram, they're in the basement. Oh, thank you, Prabhu. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. That's all the Bhagavatam is doing, is just letting us know you're not going to find it here. So then the Bhagavatam recommends the solution that we've all heard of millions of times. Those who are self-realized simply take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in order to get out of this dangerous material existence. Without accepting the devotional path, one cannot get out of the clutches of material existence. The conclusion is that no one can be happy in material life. One must take to Krishna consciousness. Because bhakti is the only way to undo our karma completely and create a new identity for the self. As long as the self has this identity that I'm something related to this world, that I should find something of meaning in this world, we have to take birth again here. That's how it works. And bhakti, effaces that old identity and creates a new identity. I'm a servant of Krishna, I'm meant to give pleasure to Krishna. So now that we've gone through some of the dark stuff, let's talk a little bit more about the pastimes of Krishna. So, one of the key things that this purport is helping us understand is that when the Lord does something, even if it's very ghastly, even if it's very gruesome, for instance, or seems very brutal, then the result is always something very beautiful. And I was thinking specifically of the Battle of Kurukshetra. The Battle of Kurukshetra, 600 million people died. 600 million people died in a matter of, I think the battle lasted 21 days. It was just 3 weeks. There were probably rivers of blood flowing out of Kurukshetra. What to speak of the devastation caused at the homes of those warriors who just lost the men of the house, right? What to speak of those millions of children that had to go grow up without fathers? This is exactly what Arjuna was worried about in the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that when you have this dushkriti, you have these, today I'm blanking out on all my Sanskrit, you know, you have these, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, you have the Varnashankara. The Varnashankara, those who are born without proper family structures, then they're going to grow up to be a little lost. They're not going to perform the proper sacrifices that will deliver their forefathers because they weren't proper, you know, the family structure was broken. Arjuna was worried about that. So the very consequences of the Kurukshetra battle were tremendous, right? But it was Krishna's desire that it take place. And why it was Krishna's desire that it take place, Srila Prabhupada explains very beautifully in the first canto, chapter 9, verse 16. I'll just read a few lines from his purport. It's really interesting and thought-provoking. So please hear carefully what Prabhupada says. He says, even the exhaustive philosophical inquiries of sages cannot ascertain the plan of the Lord. Right? So if you brought up this question in a philosophy class, what's moral? Spare the lives of these 600 million people and Duryodhan, or kill them all so that the Pandavas can have their kingdom, right? People could go on arguing for hours and days. And still to this day, people think Krishna was a diplomat. There's Hindus who think Krishna was a cunning diplomat because he allowed so many people to die. He wanted all these people to die. So still to this day, they can't figure out what was the plan of the Lord. That's what Prabhupada's saying. The best policy, however, is simply to abide by the orders of the Lord without argument. The suffering of the Pandavas were never due to their past deeds. So it's not correct to think that the Pandavas are suffering karmic reactions. Devotees don't suffer from karmic reactions. The Lord had to execute the plan of establishing the kingdom of virtue. And therefore his own devotees suffered temporarily in order to establish the kingdom of virtue. Sorry, the conquest of virtue. That's a beautiful statement. They had to suffer temporarily in order to establish the conquest, the victory of virtue. Bhishma Dev was certainly satisfied by by seeing the triumph of virtue, and he was glad to see King Yudhishthira on the throne. So Bhishma Dev, who's lying on a bed of arrows at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, when the Pandavas came seeking advice, seeking solace, because Yudhishthira was feeling extremely crestfallen. He felt himself responsible for the death of so many people, so he needed encouragement. And Krishna brought him to Bhishma Dev, knowing that only Bhishma Dev could talk sense into him at this point. And Bhishma was actually very happy. He was happy that, okay, although so many people died, still Yudhishthira is now on the throne and he's the rightful king. Although he himself fought against him, Bhishma Dev still fought against Yudhishthira, but he knew that Yudhishthira was the rightful owner to the throne. Even a great fighter like Bhishma could not win the battle of Kurukshetra because the Lord wanted to show that vice cannot conquer virtue, regardless of who tries to execute it. What a beautiful point. This is from the first canto, 9 chapter, verse 16, purport. So Prabhupada is writing here that the Lord wanted to show that vice cannot conquer virtue. And recently, one devotee came to me asking me if he should work in a facility that processes beef. He said, "What do you think I should do?" I said, "Well, I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you what the principle is, that we worship life. Life is sacred, especially Mother Cow is sacred. And therefore, we practitioners of bhakti will not try to profit in an environment where she's being tortured and killed. That's why many devotees become vegans, for instance, because they really want to protect Mother Cow." So I just said the principle, but you know, you may not be there yet. You may not have that level of compassion and that level of, you know, you could say, adherence to a higher principle, right? Because in this world, oftentimes it seems like those who compromise on values seem to profit, right? Because here's a person who can have a job and make money, but he's choosing not to do it because he wants to protect a principle. And so it looks like he's missing out. The twins, they quit their jobs because their boss told them to dissect rats. So they just quit. They said, "We're sorry, but this goes against our principles. We're not going to kill rats. You know, we're not going to kill the mice." And they're scientists. So, you know, the boss said, "You have to do this. You have to inject poison into them so they die. Then we're going to dissect them." And they said, "No, we can't do it." They quit. And when they told Srila Radhanath Swami, Radhanath Swami said, "I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you for having stuck to your values and your principles." And this is a really beautiful point, because I feel like nowadays in this world, people are so ready to easily compromise on their values and principles. It's very rare to meet somebody who has certain values and he just or she just protects them, even though it means inconvenience in the short term. Even though it means inconvenience in the short term, that no, this is a value I have and I'm going to protect it. And there's so many instances in our life when we can think of that, right? Just like, even on a day-to-day basis, you know, if it's a value of yours to chant your rounds, then even if you feel tired and lazy or sleepy or maybe whatever, then if it's a value that you really cherish, then you'll do it. And that determination to pursue a higher principle over the needs of the body and mind is what uplifts our soul. It's what gives us deep character, actually. Not to say that we should neglect the body and mind. Please don't. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to say that this is a very beautiful principle, the conquest of vice over virtue. So just like to share a few more points, and we'll open it up for a discussion. Again, our theme of this class is, whatever Krishna does, on the surface it might seem like a disturbance, but something very profound is happening. And another instance of that is Parikshit Maharaj. When Parikshit Maharaj heard that he was going to die from the curse of Sringi, what did he do? He quotes this beautiful verse in the Bhagavatam. He says, "Actually, the Supreme Personality of God has come to me in the form of a curse. Why? To detach me from my kingdom, my wealth, my opulence, and set me on the path of self-realization." So as practicing sadhakas, sometimes in our life, things might get a little shaken up. Things might get a little unpleasant. And the reason why that happens is to help remind us of what is our true need and how that need can be satisfied by turning towards Krishna. I remember when I was first coming to Krishna consciousness, that whole year, 2009, it's like all the materialistic things that I used to derive so much pleasure from completely dry. You know, I felt like I was trying to drink a lot of water, but I was always thirsty. You know, it just, nothing was, even though I had a job, I had money, I had all the things that a successful person in this world had, a really nice apartment on the lake. It just, nothing felt good anymore, you know? And I realized that something has to break outside of you so that something within you can also break, you know? That obsession, that fixation that I will find my meaning here, that inner thing has to break. But sometimes that can only break when something outside of you breaks. And that, I figured all this out when I came, after I came to Krishna consciousness, I'm like, oh, that's why that was happening. I couldn't derive pleasure from my normal activities anymore. So when I was thinking about this last night, I remembered this song that Srila Prabhupada wrote when he was in Vrindavan, after he had left his family. And it's a little book called Vrindavan Bhajan. Some of you may have read it. You're probably familiar with it. Mother Krishna, you know these songs? Vrindavan Bhajan. Prabhupada wrote these songs when he was living in Vrindavan after he had left his family and before he came to the West. These songs are very, very beautiful and very poignant. And they really emphasize this theme of how sometimes Krishna has to break something outside of you for something new to emerge. So I'll just read two verses from Vrindavan Bhajan, and I encourage you to read these on your own time. This is the voice of our Srila Prabhupada. He writes, I'm sitting alone in Vrindavan Dham. In this mood, I'm getting many realizations. I have my wife, sons, daughters, grandsons, everything. But I have no money, so they are a fruitless glory. Krishna has shown me the naked form of material nature. By his strength, it has all become tasteless to me today. It's powerful, huh? When Krishna pulls off the curtain a little bit and shows you the naked form of material nature, Jack, you might get a little bit like, whoa, is that what it's like? And Prabhupada's writing here, it has all become tasteless to me today. Yasyaham anugranami hari sheta tanam shanai. Quote, I gradually take away all the wealth of those upon whom I am merciful. It's one reason why the devotees are usually quite poor. End quote. How was I able to understand this mercy of the All-Merciful? Prabhupada continues, everyone has abandoned me, seeing me as penniless, wife, relatives, friends, brothers, everyone. I remember when I started practicing Krishna consciousness, I don't want to go out drinking anymore with my friends. I noticed how one after the other, they all just stopped calling me. This guy's boring, he never wants to go out. This is misery, but it gives me a laugh. I sit alone and laugh. In this Maya samsara, whom do I really love? Prabhupada's questioning here these deep human relationships that we think are so important. The Bhagavatam calls them fallible soldiers. You might count on them. You might think, this is my army. They will defend me from Maya's tribulations and the suffering of this world. But they're fallible soldiers. They could switch sides at any time. They could become the cause of suffering. This happens in the material world. So Prabhupada's writing here, whom do I really love? Where have all my loving father and mother gone to now? And where are all my elders who were my own folk? Who will give me news of them? Tell me who? All that is left of this family life is simply a list of names. Yeah, sounds maybe a little cold, but this is the reality of this world, that we live with people who will someday become a list of names. Again, that's not to say that we don't show affection to them and that we don't maintain nice human dealings, right? That's not the point of the Bhagavatam. In fact, a Vaishnava is always a gentleman. In fact, when Srila Prabhupada left, he told Tamal Krishna Maharaj, make sure that you send my family a little money every month. And actually, the ISKCON devotees were sending a little pension or a little retirement money to his wife. And I know that his son, Vrindavan Chandra, came to Tamal Krishna Maharaj a few times and took some financial support. So Prabhupada had that care. He had that affection, you know, that concern that they should be taken care of. Not that because something is temporary, I just cut off and just ignore it, you know. No, a Vaishnava does his duty. We do our dharma. We do what is required of us. But at the same time, the Vaishnava knows this is the reality of this material world. And at any point, Krishna will take all of this away. All of this will change. Everything that I'm attached to will be gone. And then I'll be left with what? I'll be left with my soul and my Krishna consciousness. And if I have no Krishna consciousness, then it's going to get pretty sad. It's going to get pretty rough. So, yeah, those are, let me make sure I covered everything that's in my notes. Yeah, anyways, I was thinking about telling a few stories from the Bhagavatam where Krishna does something that seems seemingly strange, but it actually works out really well at the end. I mean, one quick point I would like to mention is in the story of Jarasandha and Kalyavana, when Jarasandha attacks Mathura, Krishna uses that as a pretext to shift all the Vrishnis out of Mathura and take them to Dwarka. And so he establishes the kingdom of Dwarka, right, off the coast of Gujarat. And then Kalyavana comes with his army to attack Mathura, actually. He's very upset. He wanted to kill Krishna. And it's described how Krishna walks through the army of Kalyavana, just completely relaxed. Kalyavana was shocked. I've come to kill you, and you're just like strolling through my army. And it's described how Kalyavana was also really struck by how beautiful Krishna was. So Kalyavana decides that he's going to chase after Krishna on foot. This is Vaishnava etiquette. I mean, sorry, Kshatriya etiquette. If your opponent is unarmed, then you don't shoot him with arms. Okay, you come down to his level and meet him where he's at. So Kalyavana decides, I'm going to meet Krishna where he's at. So he chases after Krishna, and I think we're all familiar with the story. He's not able to catch Krishna. Eventually, Krishna runs into a cave where Muchukunda is sleeping, and Kalyavana thinks it's Krishna. He kicks Muchukunda. Muchukunda had a benediction that he could sleep for 1,000 years. Anybody who disturbs his sleep will burn into a crisp, like a crispy potato chip. And that's what happened to Kalyavana. Muchukunda looked at him, and with his eyes, fire came out. Kalyavana burned in front of him. So it's a very interesting pastime, because on one hand, you can say, why was Krishna afraid of Jarasandha's army? Why did Krishna have to relocate the kingdom to Dwarka? Why did he have to do that? Why did he have to run away from Kalyavana? These are all ironies, because God is unlimited. He is completely powerful. He's not afraid of anyone, nor does he have to run away from someone. But in all of these instances, Krishna is doing something very beautiful. If you read the description of Dwarka Puri, you find that actually Krishna wanted to create the perfect royal kingdom on earth. So beautiful. And build a palace for each and every one of his queens. You know, so beautiful. And at the same time, he wanted the liberation of Muchukunda, because Muchukunda woke up, and then after killing Kalyavana, he had darshan of Krishna. Muchukunda was his devotee, he offers these beautiful prayers. Muchukunda is liberated by having darshan of Krishna. So, some other, we can have the faith that although Krishna works in mysterious ways, Prabhupada writes, even the greatest philosophers can understand the plan of the Lord. And sometimes we have to go through something really, really difficult in our life. I can't even imagine what the parents of Atharva are going through, losing their only son at the age of 23, 24. Handsome young man, so gifted. Must be so difficult what they're experiencing in life. But somehow, if we can have the faith that Krishna is looking out, and ultimately it'll work out for the best for everyone involved, and we'll learn something very profound from this experience, then I think our Krishna consciousness will continue to grow. So, those are some thoughts. Do people have some reflections or corrections they would like to add?
Hare Krishna, thank you for the class.
Thanks.
Just because you're asking if you want to share, that I would share one thought. That is that in Vaikuntha, in the spiritual world, in Goloka Vrindavan, Krishna's supremacy is always meticulously intact. So one of the ways that the Lord glorifies himself is when he comes to the material world and enacts his pastimes. Because unless, sometimes this question comes up, why is there bad? In this sense, unless there's bad, you can't fully appreciate the good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless there's dark, then what's so good about light?
Right.
So when Krishna enacts his glory in this material world, it magnifies it even greater than in places where it's already well known. So I'm just relating that on this last statement where it says that the Supreme Personality of Godhead in its various forms, such as Ram and Krishna, is always transcendental. When he enacts his transcendental pastimes, the result is always beautiful and transcendental. even when the Lord performs violent acts like killing stubborn-ass demons. So this is one of the unique features of the Gokul Vrindavan. There's Gokul and Golok, and sometimes it's mentioned that even the Boma Vrindavan, the Gokul, it's even more exciting for Krishna. Because he's interacting, Prabhupada says, the Lord says, let me come and see. Let me just come and see. Right? In the spiritual world, it's the natural, healthy state. But Krishna's just out of fun. He's coming here to see. And when he does these pastimes, it captures the conditioned soul even more because they're used to that darkness and that.
Right.
And now you have this manifestation of this highest perfection,
beauty, yeah,
virtue, all of those divine qualities,
beautiful,
that he embodies. So just a thought.
What a nice reflection that by the contrast of our experience of suffering and non-beauty in this world, which is what I was describing at the beginning of class, then when we read about the beauty of Krishna, the beauty of the spiritual world, it really is a stark contrast to what we experience in the material world. Yeah, very beautiful point. And also, yeah, the special feature of Gokul here on earth is that Krishna is actually killing demons. In Goloka Vrindavan, there is a sense, when the coward boys return from the forest, there is a sense, Srila Jiva Goswami explains, that they kill demons. But actually, on earth, he's actually slaughtering demons. And there's a rasa to that. You're going to add something?
The expression that we used to hear, that light shines brighter against the black backdrop of material existence.
Yeah. Anybody else? Amshadhu Prabhu, something you would like to add? Some reflection or maybe some comment you have? No. Anybody? Okay. Oh, all right. Alex.
Hare Krishna. Appreciating your points on how one truly can't find happiness in material life. Really liking the letter that you read from Srila Prabhupada. Something I've been contemplating for a while recently, a question I have is, although one is in the material world and we're with the devotees, and life does seem blissful. We have the holy name and Srila Prabhupada, prasadam. We have the total package. And since liberation is kind of out of the picture, what is one's goal in bhakti? Because you can be like, I experience happiness in this material world, and sometimes I wonder if like that's wrong.
Sometimes you wonder if that's
wrong.
Is that your question?
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering, like, is it okay? We should be happy. It's like, well, you don't, like, Dukkhalayama Shashvatam, that sort of thing. Like, should you feel happy here? But, like, you said you can't find happiness in material life, but happiness in Krishna consciousness is real.
Yeah, so when the Bhagavatam criticizes the nature of material happiness, it's specifically pointing out the mentality of like just purely conditioned souls who think that their happiness will come from having money. Like, what do most normal people want? They want a good wife. They want a nice house. They want a Tesla. They want to have a promotion every 2 years. They want an iPhone XS, whatever the latest one is. I don't know. So the Bhagavatam is simply saying, if that's all you want, it's not going to satisfy you. That's what the Bhagavatam is criticizing. That this kind of trying mentality, just acquiring prosperity, right, and avoiding suffering by acquiring more prosperity and avoiding more suffering, right, will not make you ultimately happy. As a sadhaka, we do experience happiness. And there is also some, you could even say, Prabhupada even said, there is even a little bit of material happiness in this world. The problem is, it's like a drop of water in a desert. And I love this analogy, because the soul has a need for unlimited happiness. So we do get something in the material world. I experience some happiness, but that happiness is a result of your pious karma, which will run out at some point. So it's like a drop of water in a desert, because we want so much happiness. But if you have pious karma, then for some time you'll experience some happiness. I had pious karma. I had a good job, and you know, like, I was pretty healthy for most of my life. You know, like, I had some pious karma. So I experienced some material happiness, but even it wasn't satisfying. And then when you come to Krishna consciousness, we're actually becoming closer to Krishna, so naturally one will feel happy. Naturally one is supposed to feel happy. It's just the natural outcome of doing bhakti. In fact, one acharya has explained that the happiness of Krishna consciousness comes from Srimati Radharani, Bhakti Devi. She is pleased that you're trying to serve Krishna. And the suffering in Krishna consciousness comes from Krishna, who wants us to get even more pure. He wants to punish us for not being pure enough. So Krishna, the father, this acharya was explaining, this particular acharya is explaining, the father is punishing and the mother is rewarding. So Krishna is punishing and Radharani is rewarding. So there's some happiness, but then there's also be some struggle because we're not pure enough yet. So, and you made another point. You said, what should be the goal of Krishna consciousness? And the goal of the sadhaka is there's different goals at different stages. So before you get to the point of bhav, or the point of having ecstatic emotions for Krishna, then the goal is always purification, self-purification, and the cultivation of emotions for the Lord, the desire to please Him. That's what we should be focusing on, that my dear Lord, may I become a little bit more pure every day, and may I have a little bit more love for you every day. And I think if we look in our hearts, we'll all feel some, I definitely feel like I don't have love for Krishna. I could definitely use some love for Krishna. So simple, you know, my dear Lord, I want to become more pure so I can serve you, and I wish I had actual love to give pleasure to you. This is our goal. We work on this every single day. Try to do what we do with a little bit more attention. Love begins with attention, right? Just like if you and I are trying to have a conversation and I listen to you, that's the beginning of my love for you. At least I'm listening to you, right? So we can see that many of our activities in Krishna consciousness may always not be done with full attention. So love begins with attention. So we can aspire to be more attentive in our service, in our sadhana, in our interactions. It's the beginning of our love for Krishna. And then we can pray, my dear Lord, Srimati Radharani, give me just a drop of love. I wish I had real love. This is the goal. Our goal is, bhakti means we want to have love of God. That's the goal. In other traditions, they have other goals. But we came here because we want to love Krishna. That's our goal. If that's not your goal, then it may be hard to stick around for too long. Because how long can we keep going with some action that doesn't have a purpose? You know?
Hi, Shapri. I was just contemplating the point you raised of adhering to principles and not compromising, particularly Krishna conscious principles. So, you know, you brought up an example. So, it's not a rare example, and there are persons that practice Krishna consciousness, but maybe working in the corporate world of something like McDonald's or some other enterprise that's closely connected to the killing of cows. So, you know, the question comes, one is being spared karma through practicing Krishna consciousness, but at the same time, if one is compromising a Krishna conscious principles while performing family duties, the question comes, you know, how does that actually play itself out in devotional life? That there is this compromise of a principle, even if it's not, you know, it seems distant from the actual act of killing, but it's still in some way allowing for the maintenance of that organization through performing functions on an executive or corporate level. So, you know, that's a question.
Yeah, it's a nice question. My understanding is that all actions that can have, you could say, a negative result or a karmically negative result in the material world affects the living entity to the degree that he or she is Krishna conscious. So somebody who's very, very Krishna conscious can engage in something that seems externally quite, perhaps according to our values, incorrect or wrong. but because of the depth of their Krishna consciousness, they're just not affected by it. Just like Srila Bhakti Siddhanta could serve meat to the Viceroy of Bengal because he wanted to preach to him. So he had meat catered from a hotel in Calcutta. I'm also thinking about a story that I read, I can't tell you where, about a fisherman who was like an exalted devotee of the Lord. But that he was just born as a fisherman, so he just did that. That was what he did. But every day he would come home, take bath, do puja, read Bhagavatam, you know, like do kirtan with his family. So in my humble opinion, if we're not that developed in our spiritual practice, then it's best to live a life with, you know, it's as principle centric as possible, because not following them will have an adverse consequence, and we may not be mature enough to handle that. We may not be deep enough in our spiritual practice to actually handle the consequences of having broken principles. You know what I'm saying? Just like when someone was a new sadhaka, if they slept in for Mangal Arati one day or didn't chant their rounds, they might like not do it for the next 5 days. You know what I'm saying? But an advanced devotee can take a break sometimes because of health or whatever and jump right back on track as soon as the body is healthy again. So this is a simple example to show that maturity and depth are based on the maturity and depth, individuals are affected differently by what's happening on the surface of their life. Because, you know, yeah, we know the highest principle is this, but again, someone may not be at this level where they can follow it, right? They may not actually have the capacity to follow the highest value and principle. So, you know, because of that compromise, then there's consequences. But why are they compromising? Maybe there's a very deep reason. I don't know. It's so situational. But generally speaking, I think the more advanced, the more mature the devotee, then the less reaction he'll experience from, you know, doing something in the material world that doesn't seem right. I don't know. Do you want to add something to this? It's kind of a complex situation, right? Because it's so individual and it's so much based on the person's position and place. It's such a complex position and situation. It's not so simplistic, you know. I've heard though one time, I forget who was giving class, but something like this came up and they said, you know, sometimes, I think it was Vaisheshika Guru, he was sort of saying that sometimes you may be stuck in a certain place. It may not be the most ideal situation according to our values, but nothing's stopping us from always looking for alternatives. You know, when always, it's America, people are always changing jobs. It's like, anybody can get a job somewhere else. It's completely possible. No one is forced to work in the same place for the rest of their life. So I think that's probably the most practical solution, is if someone is in an environment like, man, you can always get another job. Plenty of places that just, yeah, that don't kill cows. I don't know. Do you want to add something to this? Okay, it's 8:31. Thank you so much for your attention. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.